Thank you, Caroline. And I think I forget, I neglected to mention at the beginning, but I'm sorry, I'm getting some feedback here. The Atlanta Freight Mobility Plan was the recipient of the 2008 AMPO National Award for Outstanding Technical Merit in Metropolitan Transportation Planning. So I encourage you all to take a look at the website here and view their plan. We're going to move on to the question and answer session now. while I go through the questions, I'm going to bring up a slide about the Freight Peer-to-Peer program in a minute. And the Atlanta Regional Commission actually recently participated in a freight peer exchange on freight and land use planning, where different agencies who have experience in freight and land use and were also trying to learn more about it came in to discuss this. I encourage you to visit the Freight Peer-to-Peer website. And if it's, if there's something of interest to you, if it's something that you either want to serve as a peer or are interested in holding a peer exchange, the information on the slide tells you where to go for more information. So we'll start off with the questions. I'm just going to kind of go starting from Caroline's and go back. So Caroline, can you highlight your experiences and lessons learned from working with the local jurisdictions?
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. That's an excellent question. We've had really some tremendous success stories with working with our local jurisdictions. One, I'll start with the most recent activity that we did. We held a freight and land use peer exchange this past August, and we had several of our local jurisdictions actually participate in that. And the key here was that they really provided us with a wealth of information and also provided us with some of the details that at the regional level we didn't really necessarily have. And so it was really, really important. And also we involved the local jurisdictions in our freight planning efforts as partners. And also we generally reach out to them during their comprehensive transportation plan. Actually, the MPO, our MPO funds their comprehensive transportation plans. So again, a key component of those plans is to address freight and land use issues. So, the coordination efforts and the working together has been really tremendous with the local jurisdictions.
Okay, thank you. How do you prevent freight facilities from expanding or redistributing their structures and activities too close to existing abutting residential areas? In New England, this seems to happen a lot.
I don't think necessarily it's something that we can prevent. I think we can minimize and mitigate some of the negative impacts that are associated with those developments. Because if you look at major metropolitan areas, you see a lot of coexistence of freight facilities as well as non-freight facilities. I think the key challenge is really to develop strategies to mitigate the impacts that are associated with those land uses by creating buffers or efficient buffers, not just buffers, but efficient buffers, and also providing the facilities such as transportation facilities that meet both the needs of freight and non-freight uses, whereby we're not, putting a heavy burden on, the existing transportation facility. So in essence, it's really not about, preventing it, but really planning better to accommodate, non-freight uses as well as freight uses.
And that's probably a good question, actually, for some of the other presenters on the line. If any of you have any thoughts on how you prevent freight facilities from expanding or redistributing their structures too close to residential areas. Do any of the other presenters have any thoughts on that?
That's really a discussion item for the local community, because in so many areas, there's home rule and the municipalities decide. But a lot of it goes to what Carolyn talked about, other areas. Of really thinking through how various land uses work with each other. And the other problem is, what happens when there was an industrial use there first and other land uses develop afterwards? How do you then go back, or how do you make them all work together? And I think we've discussed some of the techniques that are available.
Okay, thank you.
And just to add, Jennifer, as mention, in a lot of cases, especially in our region, it's the opposite. It's not necessarily freight uses encroaching on residential areas, but it's the other way around, where residential uses are encroaching on historically freight areas. So, it's in our region, we're not really seeing, the opposite.
Okay, thank you. Caroline, do you have a specific set of freight-friendly design standards for urban areas?
The guidelines that we developed were not really specific since it was an original study. We didn't really highlight just for an urban area. We did it on a regional level.
Okay. And how did you track construction vehicle flows?
Construction vehicle flows, we tracked that from the data that we got. As part of the study, we acquired Transit data, which is a national proprietary comprehensive freight data that we acquired as part of the freight mobility plan, and it provides more to provide commodities, it provides what routes they use, and also we use other databases, as well as we did interviews, origin destination interviews, and then we did local interviews with the freight stakeholders in the region, and it was kind of a compilation of a lot of that information.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to some questions for Jim now. Let's see here. What analysis and promises about truck access to the MISOD were necessary to get the city to adopt it?
I can say a couple things. The city did this pretty much on their own, although there was some additional capital funds that the state, the Maryland Department of Transportation, assisted with some of the access roads going through different terminals in the port. I don't think that was a lot of money, and that I think maybe in the neighborhood of $7 to $10 million, and that's in addition to the highway user revenues that the city gets. But we stress that these maritime uses created jobs, and we showed the economic impact that the port has on the city and the region, and pointed out that the city knows that there's a lot of the residents, a lot of the direct jobs are held by residents of the city, and many of these people do not have higher education degrees, and with the industrial base eroding from old cities like Baltimore and anywhere in the United States, there's a need for employment for this sector of the population. So I guess a combination of the soft and then the dollars to help with some of the city's roads leading to port terminals, and we're tickled that the city passed this a few years ago, and we're tickled that they're contemplating an extension.
Okay, great, Jim. We have another question for you. Our recent study showing a doubling of cargo by 2020.
Well. I guess it depends on what recent means. Obviously, since, say, August of this year, there's been an enormous economic slowdown. I know of no studies since then. The people have been reporting that the number of containers have slowed, and other commodities have also slowed. But most of the studies that we relate to are national studies that the Maritime Administration conducts, and they don't have a recent one that I'm familiar with. And I think the last I've seen, they're still sticking to their guns that things are going to double by the year 2020. And that's using the year 2000 as a starting point. So that's kind of a non-answer. I apologize.
That's okay. Okay, we're going to move on now to some questions for Anne. Were some of the freight villages at former military arsenals built after BRAC closures?
There certainly seems to be a definite linkage between being a former military base and becoming a freight village or ILC. And I think this has been going on since before the BRAC process, and probably because many of the original military bases were situated in a good logistics location and had great rail access. Raritan Center was a military arsenal that was sold to the public in the 1960s, and actually they had a difficult time selling it because no one wanted to take on the trouble of trying to demolish very tightly built concrete structures. They were designed to withstand aerial bombing from World War II, so they had difficulty actually selling it. But it does seem to be related in some way.
Okay, thank you. The next question for you is, the term village makes a freight operation sound innocuous, but savvy communities are still likely to be opposed to such development. Can these projects still be economically viable at far smaller scales?
This is a really excellent question, because anything with the term freight in it sends off negative connotations whether we like it or not. And in fact, with regard to the Somerset County project, the Compact Freight Village, we met with Duke Estates, the conservators for the Eco Preserve next to it. In fact, there was a lot of concern that they would negatively react to a freight use. Instead, they embraced it as it's a really great way of showing how various land uses could work together. But coming out of our conversation was this very question that saying freight village was potentially at public hearings going to set off a negative connotation, and they actually suggested that we go with the term business gateway. And and in fact, they came to public meetings to support the concept. So first of all, yes, there are other ways of terming this development, and business gateway seems to be one that's worked quite well. Can they be economically viable on smaller sites? They do appear to be able to do that. The question is whether that rail yard, whether we have sufficient rail yard to make it viable for the railroads.
Okay, and then another question for you. How do you quantify the local traffic impacts of these centers? What is expected from the developers in terms of infrastructure on the local road network?
Exactly what would be expected of developers of any kind of industrial park in a local setting. So the developers have to come forward and indicate what kind of development they anticipate is going to occur there, their typical truck generation rule elements that are used. Where it can be mitigated in terms of the truck generation is the fact that at least one side of the traffic coming into the facility to potentially leaving it is going by an alternative mode. So that goes into the calculation, and it is factored in. What makes a freight village more palatable than a typical industrial development to municipality is the fact that it does have multiple modes used. It does bring industrial development into one aggregated area as opposed to having it dispersed, and it generally does bring those brownfields back. And again, with some of these techniques of berming, dealing with light spillage, or having activities that are mutually beneficial to the community and the development, that works well when going for approvals.
Okay, thank you. We're now going to move on to some questions for Daniel and Mark. What models did your research employ to study the relationship between past freight activities to current land use pattern changes? Did you use any spatial econometric models, and do the models include freight through airways, waterways, and roadways?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So thus far, what we've been proposing to use is to focus on limited dependent variable models, that is, models that have categorical dependent variables. And in the case of our analysis, in which we look at sort of the relationships cross-sectionally, we're looking at no or low freight-related land uses, medium high uses, and then high clustering freight-related land uses. When we look at change, then we're looking at the dependent variables as no change, deconcentration, or increased concentration over time. Because they are limited dependent variables, we have not used spatial econometrics, and from my understanding, most of those models of that incorporate spatial effects tend to be implemented with continuous dependent variables. We are pondering the use of geographic weighted regression, and that's sort of an advanced tool. So the bottom line is, yes, I think there are strong effects, and I think it's a great question, spatial effects, but that the incorporation of those in these types of models is not that straightforward.
Thank you. The next question for you is, what data and information are key when blending freight studies and land use overlays and forecasts?
Yes, and I think this relates to the previous question about the different types of freight modes that are being considered. I think that the two main sources of data that we want to have, and I think the Atlanta case was similar, number one is we want to have information about freight activity, and that's a really hard question. It's a really hard piece of data. You want it by mode, you want it by probably freight value and tonnage over time. And so when you can't get that data from existing public records, you have to go with the databases, for example, that Atlanta had to supplement for their study. We've explored and have found the feasibility of using the freight analysis framework, this tool that that FHWA has put together, fairly useful depending on the area that you're focusing on. They have tonnage and value of goods shipped by type of commodity and mode of transportation for, I think, 100-plus, 114 areas or so. And for highways, they have even more disaggregated information at the county level. 2002, I think they're coming up with an updated version very soon. That's on the freight activity side of things. On the land use type of side of things, we would like to get much parcel information with land use data attached to it as possible to glean whether the use is indeed a freight-related use or not. I think in the past, many of us have been using economic activity codes like SIC codes or NICE codes, but they're not that useful because we really want to know that what we're seeing is a warehouse, regardless of whether it's a warehouse that's owned by Target or Walmart, or whether it's a warehouse that's owned by a logistics or a carrier company. So NICE codes would give us a skewed picture. I think land use databases attached to the parcel, pretty much what MPOs tend to have, but not historically for the most part, are really what would make these types of analysis more feasible.
Okay, thank you. And are any of your studies available online?
Yes, the studies we've completed, like the airport study, is available, and I'll be happy to point the URL, or folks can email me. I can send my email via the comments so that I can give them the URL for download.
Yeah, that's fine, or you could even type the URL into the chat area if you'd like.
Okay, I don't have it quite handy, but I will.
Okay, that's fine. How did you derive the top factors affecting businesses? Are they from a survey or interviews?
Yeah, these top factors came from a meta-analysis that we did of the literature, and I think the questioner is right that one way to validate those would be to consider a national or a regional survey of shippers and carriers, but we haven't done that.
Okay. And the last question I see typed in is actually a question that is directed to everybody. What have you done in support of direct rail service to mitigate congestion associated with truck-heavy freight planning? Is there anybody who would like to jump in and respond to that?
I will jump in. As part of what we did with developing our freight mobility plan, we actually did an analysis of our freight rail network. And the challenge there is that very few people understand the constraints that the rail network faces. They pretty much face the same issues of congestion as the highway network. So that was really kind of an eye-opener for our region, because our elected officials were saying, oh yeah, why can't we just move all those trucks to rail? But when we presented that information to them, and also we found out that most of the rail network are single tracked, and some of them are shared by passenger rail. For instance, in our region, it's Amtrak. And Amtrak, when Amtrak comes and stops in our region, it pretty much blocks freight rail operations for at least 2 hours each day. So, you know, again, the challenge there is critical. you know, to understand the constraints that are faced by the freight rail sector, and not just assume that, you know, the modal shifts can occur without any investments on the rail side. Yes, there's potential, but again, yes, there's need for investments in the rail network in order to be able to shift, you know, experience the modal shift that we hoped for.
I'd like to add something. This is Daniel Rodriguez. I think the response was right on. There is there was until, say, August, very slim margins of capacity in the railroads. And I think about 2 months ago, or 2 years ago, we saw the incredible breakdown of one of the big seven in terms of the capacity to move cars in a rail yard and get them to the Midwest. So I think it's fairly complex because they also manage their yield in a fairly sophisticated way, as airlines do. So getting their incentives to collaborate and to get more freight that in sometimes might not be within their radar screen might be really hard and will require, I think, some sort of lubrication of the wheels and support from the public sector.
Well, actually, you just was a great lead into what I was going to say on freight villages, because freight villages can provide that incentive within the railroad financials, because the whole idea of aggregating industrial activity means that you can amass that critical mass that Class 1 railroads deem necessary to have freight service to an area. Within an ILC, there may be a short line operator. In the case of Raritan Center and Pure Land, there are short line railroads handling things and assembling it. But Raritan Center, for example, has 4,000 or 5,000 carloads a year, and that attracts Class 1 attention. Pure Land also, 5,000 or 6,000 carloads a year. That is what Class 1s look for.
Okay, thank you. At this point, we are about out of time, and I think we've gotten through everything that was typed in. So I don't think we're going to have time to open the phone line today, but I know we got through a lot of questions, so hopefully we got everything answered. I want to thank all the presenters for today. We had great presentations, and this was one of the most popular seminars that we've had so far, so I hope it was enjoyed by all. And thank you, everybody, for attending today. The recorded version and the PowerPoints and the transcript will be available in a few weeks on the Talking Freight website, and I'll send out an email when that becomes available. The next seminar is going to be held on December 10th and will be about establishment surveys. Keep in mind, the seminar is being held on the second Wednesday of the month instead of the usual third Wednesday due to the upcoming holidays. And so if you haven't done so already, you can go to the Talking Freight website and register for this seminar. The address is up on the red slide showing on your screen. And I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv. So with that, we will close out for today. Thank you, everybody, and thank you to all the presenters. It was a great seminar.